Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live once more for an hour, as we are each weekday afternoon, taking your phone calls. If you have questions you would like to ask on the air about the Bible or the Christian faith, or bring up some topic for discussion that maybe you see differently than the host does, want to bring up an alternative point of view, feel free to give me a call. Right now our lines are full, which means you will not be able to get through if you call this moment, but that will be changing as the program progresses. Lines open up and you can get through if you have this number handy and use it at the right times. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And since this is Wednesday, I want to announce to our Southern California listeners that every Thursday morning, so that's tomorrow morning early at 6:30, I have a Bible study I teach on the life and teachings of Christ. We're going through all four of the Gospels in a harmony of the Gospels, taking the life and teachings of Jesus chronologically. And it's an in-depth study, and you're welcome to join us. That's open to the public. The Bible study is held at Panera Bread, the Panera Bread restaurant in Temecula, which is across the street from Costco in Temecula. So that's every Thursday morning, including tomorrow. And you're welcome to join us if you happen to be in Southern California and want to make the drive early in the morning, 6:30, Panera Bread in Temecula. There's information and a map and so forth at our website, thenarrowpath.com. All right, let's talk to some callers so that we can get this show on the road, as it were. Dennis from Orange County, California, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hello. How are you doing? Yes, I have a question.
Yeah, I'm fine. Thanks.
Okay, great. Yeah, I have a question about recently I've met about three people recently who are, I was sharing, grace, with them. And they're into this mosaic, following the Shabbat. They're not Adventists, but they do the Shabbat, they're following, they believe you have to follow these mosaic laws. And they also, believe in, grace. And they sound like, they've got very legalistic. I don't know, is this a trend now, or?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it is a trend. There are very many people who are going this direction. I don't agree with it, but it's the direction of Torah observance. Somehow some people have gotten it through their head that Christians are supposed to observe the Torah ceremonies. That would include Sabbath, but it would also include the other festivals of the Jews, the festivals of Israel that God gave them. It would include a kosher diet. It would include essentially everything except the important things. Now, when I say the important things, Jesus said the important things are justice, mercy, and faithfulness. Now, I'm not saying that they wouldn't say those are important things. They would, I'm sure. But they're not recognizing everything else as very unimportant. And if you want to consider Jewish ceremonies to be an important thing, then the most important of the Jewish ceremonies, judging from the number of chapters devoted to it in the Old Testament, would be the animal sacrifices. There are chapter after chapter after chapter in the Old Testament, in the Torah, commanding the offering of animal sacrifices of various types in the altar, in the temple or the tabernacle, which was eventually in Jerusalem. Now, under the law, the Israelites were required to make trips to Jerusalem three times a year and offer these animal sacrifices at their festivals. Now, those who say that we must keep the Jewish festivals, I guess they feel they're entitled to change them at will. Because if they say we must keep tabernacles or Pentecost or Passover, I'm going to have to ask them, really, how do you keep them? Under the law, these require that priests of the Mosaic order, the Aaronic order, that they would offer sacrifices. That's what was the central celebration of the festivals. Not only festivals, but every day of the year was celebrated with animal sacrifices, and it was a command of the Torah. So everyone knows there's no temple in Jerusalem right now, and that no Levitical priests are there, and there's no sacrifice being offered. So it's very clear that one cannot keep the Torah. God himself has eliminated that possibility by allowing the temple to be destroyed. In fact, Jesus indicated that the destruction of the temple was a judgment from God upon Israel for their rejection of him. And that being so, we can say that the temple does not exist because God doesn't want it to exist. And if God doesn't want it to exist, then he doesn't want animal sacrifices. And if he doesn't want animal sacrifices, then there's no reason to believe he wants any other part of the Torah to be observed. The sacrifices were the central part of Torah observance. These other things were really just, you know, dates on the calendar when you would come and offer more animal sacrifices. And I think this is a movement that is really a resurgence of the Galatian heresy, in my opinion. The book of Galatians was written against this very view, and Paul encountered it early on because there were people who thought that it's okay to be saved by Christ as long as you're also keeping the Torah. And that's what Paul refused to agree with. And I believe that Paul understood the gospel better than the Judaizers did and better than the modern Judaizers do. So you are running into this. You'll run into it more and more and more. It's a huge movement. And it's not all one movement. It's not all one organization. It's just like it's a general misperception of the will of God that is being promoted by many teachers, many of them just making a name for themselves, some of them the heads of organizations. And it simply has no support in the New Testament. And the New Testament is the covenant we live under. We don't live under the old covenant. We live under the new covenant. And you can't live under both, because it says in Hebrews that the coming of a new covenant has made the old covenant obsolete. So you have to take your pick. You can live under an obsolete old covenant, or you can live under the new covenant, which God recognizes and which is a means of salvation. That's what I would recommend to Christians.
Excellent. Yeah, that's exactly how I feel.
All right.
I didn't know where this was all coming from, because I just met three people in the last show, and they're younger people, very knowledgeable of the Bible and everything. But when I would quote something, they would come back with something else. It was really interesting. So I just was hoping to.
Jehovah's Witnesses seem like the Jehovah's Witnesses at your door sometimes sound as if they're very knowledgeable about the Bible. No, they aren't. They don't know the Bible very well at all, but they do know the specific verses that support the specific points that they've been indoctrinated in. And therefore, this is the way cults are. They don't inculcate a general knowledge of the Bible. They inculcate special proof texting arguments for special points that they make out to be, the distinctives of their movement. And so you'll find Jehovah's Witnesses, Mormons, any cultic group that uses the Bible is going to seem to you, perhaps at times, as if they're really knowledgeable about the Bible. The truth is, these people don't know the Bible very well at all. They don't have a very thorough knowledge of the Bible. They know some teacher has taught them certain things and given them some proof text for it. It's clear in this movement, as well as the JWs or Mormons, that the people who are using these proof texts do not have at all a grasp of the context of the passages they're using, and that is a mark of not being very biblically literate. Believe me, I know their arguments. I've heard them. It only takes a medium knowledge of the Bible to see that they are missing the whole point of the passages they quote. If you have a good knowledge of the Bible, you won't be susceptible to their points at all.
Yeah, I wasn't influenced by it at all. But I just thought, well, how can I help these guys see it? You know. So it was great. Thank you. I really appreciate that. It was very good. Yeah, very insightful.
All right, Dennis. Okay, thanks for your call. Let's talk. I think there's a delay on the line. I'm noticing that when I stop speaking, there's a gap before the caller calls back. So that's just something we can't control. Once in a while, that's there. So just allow for that in a conversation here. We'll talk next to William calling from Irvine, California. William, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Yes, Steve. Thank you for taking my call. I really appreciate it, and I appreciate your answer before and the other answer yesterday on the temple. That was wonderful. But anyway, my question, I want to know if I need to be corrected in my understanding or something, because it's kind of a heavy thing on me somewhat. There's been a few people in our fellowship that have died, you know, in the last within the past year or so, and they'll have a memorial for the person and so forth. They'll everything. And I don't know if I agree with that, where we give memorializing to anybody, you know, to any human or anything, other than what Jesus said at the Last Supper. You know, do this in remembrance of me, the body and blood. But am I being too legalistic in a way to not think properly of attending a memorial for a person that has passed away, and you know, in the arms of the Lord, that they were believers and everything, so you know, not give any glory to humans.
Well, a memorial is not a worship service. It's not idolatrous to remember somebody, especially. Let's put it this way, if it was your own father or your own mother, though you don't worship them, you would, I would think, want to, respect them and let others know how much you respect them. And therefore, a memorial service might be one way to do that. I don't think it's necessary to have memorial services, but I don't think there's anything wrong with it either. Frankly... A lot of times at a memorial service, people will get up and speak about things that, you know, that they experienced with the person who's passed.
Yeah, well,
which
all kinds of wonderful
most
things
of people,
about the person.
Yeah, and which most people may not be aware of. And to tell you the truth, a good example is a good thing. And if somebody has died with a good example, then it's a good thing to remember that. Remember the book of Hebrews chapter 11 goes through all the good examples of the Old Testament, Abel and Enoch and Noah and Abraham and Isaac and Jacob and Moses Joshua and so forth. And it tells us the good things they did through faith. And, of course, James tells us in James chapter 5, remember, my brethren, the prophets who spoke in the name of the Lord as an example of suffering, affliction, and patience. And you've heard of the patience of Job. He says you need to remember that, too. You know, these people in the Old Testament and, frankly, people who've died in New Testament times often are such a great example to us that it'd be a shame for their example to be totally blotted out with their death. After all, in many cases, some of the best examples we have are people who aren't alive today. I know that I have received more inspiration reading biographies of great Christians who are no longer living.
You're right. Yeah.
Than I have in company of living Christians in most cases. You know. So.
That's right.
And that too is a memorial. So as long as you're not worshiping the person, obviously you don't want to deify the person. But
right, exactly.
If you're remembering their virtues in such a way as they provide an inspiration to other people, maybe some who didn't know them as well, but who would benefit by knowing what a fine person they were. I don't think there's anything wrong with complimenting or acknowledging or honoring a person in their lifetime for honorable things they've done. And I don't think the honorableness of their actions ceases to be honorable when they're dead. You know, they're not going to do any more honorable actions after that, but the ones they did are still memorable and honorable. So I think honoring what is honorable is a good thing.
Oh, my. Thank you, Steve. That was so... Yes, I thank you so much. I got more information, and now I just really feel at peace with it and everything. And thank you so much. One real quick thing. Have you read anything by T. Austin Sparks?
Yes, long time ago. What was that called?
He's also passed on, too, and I'm just saying I gleaned a lot of his past writings.
Oh, right. So, well, a lot of my favorite writers are no longer living, and not only their writings, but their biographies. I mean... A.W. Tozer was a great hero of mine.
Tozer, yes, and Pink, A.W.
Yeah,
Pink. Oh, my.
Pink is good. Pink was good, too, yeah. And C.S. Lewis and, frankly, some of the Puritan writers. William Law is one of my favorite writers when I was younger. I'm still reading him. He was a great man. And frankly, the lives of great men and women challenge us and basically challenge the low norms of religiosity.
Right,
that
right.
We tend to see around us. You know, it's when you're going to church and no one is really more spiritual than you are. In fact, a lot of people are, you know, living a very poor example of what Christianity should be.
Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing to be exposed to somebody, even if they're no longer living, who lived as Christians ought to live. George Mueller was one of my favorites, too, and Hudson Taylor. These are, you know, men whose lives of faith are an inspiration. But, frankly, those men I just mentioned were an inspiration to me from my youth and have challenged me to live the way I've lived for the past 50 years.
Praise God.
To honor honorable men and to be inspired by them is a very legitimate thing biblically.
Thank you so much, Steve. I bless you. Have a wonderful week.
Okay, same to you, William. Thanks for calling.
All right, bye-bye.
Good talking to you. Bye now. All right, our next caller is Michael from Live Oak, and we have lines open right now, a couple of lines open for those who would like to be on the program. The number is 844-484-5737. Do you have a question about the Bible or the Christian faith or maybe a difference of opinion from the host? Feel free to give me a call. The number is 844-484-5737. Michael, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. Good to hear you. I normally wouldn't call back in the course of 1 week, but last night I was catching the repeat of The Narrow Path, listening, and I heard a gentleman, he was asking about how sin is understood in Buddhism. I don't remember the man's name, but so I wanted to very quickly address that.
Right.
So, yeah, basically, Christians and Buddhists would agree that certain behavior, murder, stealing, adultery, that is adharmic, meaning going against dharma or going against God's will, that would be pretty much the same. But beyond that, Buddhism has given causes for how the Buddha would have described the underlying causes of sin or unkind conduct or selfish behavior. That would be coming, that everything begins in the mind, according to the Buddha's basic teaching. So the disposition of grasping, of hatred, of ignorance, that's the underlying root cause of these different discordant ways of relating to others.
Yeah. Well, in that respect, of course, Michael, in that respect, of course, Buddhism isn't different than Christianity in seeing that sin begins with the inner life, the mind. Jesus said it's not what goes into a man's mouth that defiles him, it's what comes out of his mouth, because that comes out of the heart. He said, out of the heart come all these wicked things. So that would be partially a similar assessment of sin. But as I said to the caller yesterday, the significant difference is that in the Christian worldview, sin is a betrayal of love. There is a loving God to whom we owe our obedience and our devotion, who made us, who has given us every good thing, to whom nothing but gratitude is due and loyalty and so forth. And when we sin, we are betraying the love of somebody who loves us and that we ought to love back. Now, in Buddhism, of course, there's not necessarily a God to be found anywhere. And therefore, to act adharmic or against dharma is acting against a principle, against a law, and against one's own benefit, I think. And that would be a big difference between, of course, Buddhism and Christianity. And you and I, whenever we talk about this, I've tried to get that across to you. There's, for all the similarities that exist in the ethical ideas of Buddhism and Christianity, frankly, those same ethics, there's a tremendous overlap in the ethics of Christianity and Judaism, or the ethics of Christianity and Islam, or Buddhism or Hinduism. But of course, all these religions differ in the most important ways. Unfortunately, when we mistakenly think, well, both of these, all these religions, they teach pretty much the same thing about living a good life. So isn't that all that matters? Well, no, that's not all that matters. The fact that they have all those things in common indicates that those are not the things that are central to them, or else the religions would be the same. But the religions are different. They're all different from each other in their presuppositions. Christianity holds that there is a God, that he sent his son, Jesus Christ, to be our king and our master, that following him and obeying him is every human being's duty and responsibility, and sin is the failure of that duty and the betrayal of the king, which is a very relational kind of thing. Whereas in Hinduism or in Buddhism or in some other religion that doesn't really have God. Of course, Hinduism has lots of gods, but Buddhism doesn't necessarily have a god. Then sin or, you know, bad behavior has got to be interpreted some other way. And it is. And every religion has their own way of defining it. But as I was saying, I told the caller yesterday that I was no expert on Buddhism and couldn't tell him exactly in the terms a Buddhist would use what they would think about sin. But I did mention, as you did, that Buddhists believe there is wrong behavior. And I think that, but I also mentioned the difference I just mentioned to you. And obviously, that's a significant difference. If wrongdoing is something that primarily hurts me in this life or in the next, then it's pretty much all about me, isn't it? I mean, on the other hand, if wrongdoing is hurting somebody that I'm deeply indebted to and who's done nothing but love me and do good to me, then this is a great atrocity, a great betrayal. And it's not just how it's going to hurt me in this life or the next. It's that I've hurt somebody who does not deserve me hurting him at all. And that's the fundamental difference. And I appreciate you calling. I actually thought you might call back to clarify that for him, and I'm glad you did. Kind of confirmed what I thought. All right, let's talk next to Steve from Seattle. Steve, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. Hello, Steve? Okay, it doesn't sound like Steve is connected here. I'll hang up there. Let's talk to John from McMinnville, Oregon. John, are you there?
I'm here. How you doing, Steve?
Good.
Hey, first of all, before I get to my question, some time ago you had someone call in and interact with you a little bit about the flat Earth. They were supporting a flat Earth idea.
Right.
And, you know, I kind of got the impression that you weren't very patient with that.
No, I'm not very patient with it, I have to admit.
You aren't. Yeah. I've been watching some of the YouTube videos. Man, you ought to talk with those people. That's good radio.
That's good for Coast to Coast AM. That's not good for the Narrow Path.
I know. But so I'm going to bring up a topic. I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on this. I'll bring it up and then listen to your thoughts off.
Okay.
On the air. So, in continuing to explore the whole matter of orthodoxy, you know, the Orthodox Church, as you know, there's a ton of things that they do, a lot of ritual, a lot of tradition. And they say that the reason why they do it is because that's the way that the church has always done it. That's a rich, you know, history and all the way back to the beginning of the church. And, of course, when I look at them, like, I just sure don't see it. They're just mistaken. I mean, what they call back at the beginning is often maybe the 3rd or 4th century. But
right.
I was looking specifically at their thoughts on baptism and communion and things. And, you know, they won't baptize someone unless they've been chrismated. And, of course, they have a closed communion. We couldn't just step in and join them in communion. That's safe for people who have been baptized, particularly in the Orthodox Church. And as I look at it, I see that there's that things started to get kind of ritualistic pretty early on. What I have in mind is the Didache, or Didache, whatever. An example of this is, if I recall correctly, in that document, they were saying that people would not be baptized unless they had fasted for like 3 days.
Yeah, they were told to fast in advance of being baptized. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'm kind of curious to hear your thoughts about, you know, those early traditions. I think it's unfortunate just because I think, well, although it was recognized as an early tradition there, I certainly wouldn't necessarily promote it because just for the simple reason that I just don't see the early church living that out, particularly in the apostolic age, I'm confident we're probably on the same page there, but I'm just wondering about some of those early, what your thoughts are on some of the early rituals and how you interact with that.
Well, John, like I said, you'll take it off here. Okay. I appreciate that. God bless. I think the human flesh tends toward religiosity, and religiosity tends toward uncostly devotion. Costly devotion is where you have to deny yourself, take up your cross, and follow Jesus day by day, saying no to your flesh, mortifying the deeds of the body, walking in the Spirit, loving, sacrificing, for Christ and for others every single day. That's what real spirituality calls a person to. How much easier to adopt a few rituals, which you only have to learn, and then you can go through them painlessly and feel that they have some significance. And this is the direction that even true spiritual behavior tends to get modified in generations that practice it without the same original fervor. And let's face it, there's never been a revival yet that has carried on its original fervor into a second generation, nor into a third. I mean, the movement sometimes remains, but the revival dies down and the movement becomes institutionalized. That's how revivals have been historically. The early church was a revival. It was spiritual. There were people who were expected to believe and follow in Jesus Christ with all their heart. Eventually, it was good enough just to be part of the church and do the rituals. Of course, they were expected to believe, they were expected to love, and so forth. But that was, you know, that wasn't the sign that you were really a Christian. The sign that you were a Christian was that you'd gone through the rituals of baptism and so forth. As you mentioned, the Didache says that people should fast before they're baptized. Well, fasting requires some delay. You can't, unless you're going to fast for a few minutes before you're baptized. But what is a fast of a few minutes worth? But in the New Testament, people baptized their converts as soon as they were believers. So you can see that even by the end of the first century, when the Didache was written, already in the second generation, some of the practices that were spiritual practices in the early church were now being institutionalized into ritualistic practices, and things were being added to it. Traditions were being added, as is so often the case. I need to take a break here for 30 seconds. I'll be right back.
So when the show is over, come on over to thenarrowpath.com. Learn, study, enjoy. We thank you for your support, and we thank you for listening each day to The Narrow Path. We now return you to The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg.
All right, welcome back to The Narrow Path radio broadcast, the second half of the program. We have lines open, as we did in the first half of the program, for you to call if you have questions about the Bible or about the Christian faith. Feel free to join us here. The number to call is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737 if you'd like to join us on the program today. Let's talk to Tunde from San Francisco next. Tunde, welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling. Good to hear from you.
Thank you. Thanks for sharing your wisdom, always. My question is, what is the difference between hell, Hades, and lake of fire? And the second question would be, when Jesus died, where did Jesus go? Did he go to Hades or did he go to hell to rescue the souls of those who lived righteous, died before the coming of the first coming of Christ? I'm going to take my answer off the air. Thank you, Steve.
Okay. Great to hear from you. I'll address that. So what is the difference between hell, Hades, and the lake of fire? Well, that depends on how we want to use the word hell, because there's not really a word in the New Testament that really serves the purpose of what we mean by hell usually. Usually what we mean by hell is we make a distinction between where the righteous go and where the wicked go after the final judgment. Jesus comes back, he judges the dead, and some go off into everlasting life, some into everlasting punishment, as it says in Matthew chapter 25 and verse 46. This everlasting punishment is also apparently the same place referred to as the lake of fire in Revelation chapter 20 in verse 10 and 11 and 15 and so forth. The lake of fire is mentioned several times there as the place where after the judgment day, the wicked go to the lake of fire. That is what I would usually refer to as hell. Although, of course, the word hell doesn't translate them. Hell is an English word, but lake of fire and eternal punishment, things like that, are words in English translating phrases in the Bible, which are referring, in my opinion, to what we call hell. Now, the word hell in English Bibles has traditionally been used to translate three different words. In the Greek, one is Hades, one is Tartarus, and one is Gehenna. And all three of those words are translated with the same English word hell in the English Bible usually, at least in the King James Version. Now, Hades is not the same thing as the lake of fire. Therefore, if we're thinking of the lake of fire as hell, then we shouldn't use the word hell to speak of Hades. because Hades is not described as hell. Hades, in fact, is thrown into the lake of fire in Revelation chapter 20 and verse 14. Death and Hades are thrown into the lake of fire. So Hades is distinct from the lake of fire, therefore it's distinct from hell. According to Scripture, Hades is where the dead go, all the dead. Actually, Hades is simply the place of the dead. It's not specifically a place of punishment or a place of reward. In fact, it would appear that in the mind of the Jews in Jesus' day, Hades had two compartments. The wicked went to Hades into a place of punishment, and the righteous went to Hades to a place of comfort. But neither of them were in their eternal place. In Hades, this is just where the dead would be until the end of the world. At the end of the world, Jesus will return. He'll raise the dead. There will be a final judgment. And then those who are thrown into the lake of fire are gone into what we call, what we would probably call hell. So I would not equate Hades with hell if by hell we're thinking of the final judgment at the day of judgment when Jesus returns, the final judgment of the wicked. That's what I think of as hell. And therefore, Hades is not that. And it was a mistake for Hades to be translated as hell because of that misunderstanding. You asked, did Jesus go to hell or did he go to Hades? The Bible says he was not left in Hades. Hades just means in the place of the dead. It doesn't say he was in flames. It doesn't say he was in Abram's bosom. It just says he was in the place of the dead, Hades. And therefore, there's no very good reason to say that Jesus went to hell. People like to sometimes say he went to hell for various preaching purposes, and even the creeds sometimes say he went to hell. But the Bible doesn't say that. The Bible does imply he went to Hades and was not left in Hades, but resurrected. But the translation of Hades as hell is a mistake. Tartarus is another Greek word that's translated as hell, but it only appears once in the Bible, in 2 Peter 2:4, and it's sort of like Hades for angels. People go to Hades. Angels who sin go to Tartarus. And as you read in 2 Peter 2:4, Tartarus is the place where the fallen angels, the sinful angels, have been incarcerated for the present as they await the final judgment. So just as, human dead go to Hades until the final judgment, so angels go to Tartarus until the final judgment if they're sinners. But neither of those are the final judgment itself. The fallen angels apparently go into the lake of fire. Also, we find that Satan does in Revelation chapter 20 and verse 11. Satan is thrown into the lake of fire. So it would appear the demons, the Satan and his angels, and the wicked people go into the lake of fire. That's not Hades and that's not Tartarus, but both of them, unfortunately, have been translated hell in our Bibles, which was a mistake. The remaining Greek word that is translated as hell in the Bible is Gehenna. Now, Gehenna, in the mind of the rabbis, Gehenna was a place of judgment after death. The rabbis, beginning and influenced by the book of Enoch, a couple centuries before Christ, Enoch suggested that Hades had two compartments. One was paradise, and one was Gehenna. And the righteous went to paradise, and the wicked went to Gehenna, and there they burned. Now, according to the rabbis, those who went to Gehenna would be there for 12 months. Some taught that they would be released from Gehenna and restored to God after 12 months. Some taught that they would be annihilated after 12 months. But this is the rabbinic teaching, that Gehenna was a place of punishment after death. Now, Jesus used the word Gehenna. The other writers of the scripture did not. Jesus used the word Gehenna as a place where the wicked would go. That is, his listeners, if they rejected him, were courting the disaster of Gehenna. And therefore, translators in the English have always tended to translate Gehenna as hell and have equated it with the lake of fire. Well, while this is a possibility, I would challenge us not to take it too firmly, because Gehenna doesn't mean the lake of fire. Gehenna doesn't even mean hell. It's true the word had been applied artificially by the rabbis to a post-mortem judgment. But Gehenna has an actual meaning in the Greek. The Greek word Gehenna literally would be translated the Valley of Hinnom. And the Valley of Hinnom is an actual place. It's a valley southwest of Jerusalem. I've walked in Gehenna myself. I've walked in that valley just southwest of Jerusalem. A lot of green grass there. It's not flames anymore. But Gehenna was the place that Jeremiah the prophet said the wicked Jews who rebelled against God would have their corpses deposited when the Babylonians would come and destroy Jerusalem, which the Babylonians did in 586 BC. They wiped out so many Jews, they didn't bury them all. They just threw them into a mass grave in the valley of Gehenna. And therefore, Jeremiah, twice in his book, warns that Gehenna, the valley of Hinnom, will no longer be called the valley of Hinnom, but it'll be called the valley of slaughter because of the abundance of corpses that will be thrown into it. He's talking about the war dead, those that will be killed by the Babylonians. Now, Jesus also warned that his listeners were in danger, if they rejected him, of being thrown into Gehenna, the valley of Hinnom. Now, interestingly enough, Jesus was preaching in a time just before Jerusalem was about to be destroyed again. Jeremiah preached just before the destruction of Jerusalem in 586 BC. Jesus preached just before the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. The same thing happened to Jerusalem twice in history. Jeremiah warned of it the first time. Jesus warned of it the second time. Now, Jesus used the same kind of language as Jeremiah. He indicated that those who rejected him would be cast into Gehenna or the Valley of Hinnom. This is not necessarily a reference to a post-mortem state of judgment. It certainly wasn't when Jeremiah spoke of it. Jeremiah just spoke of it as an undignified end, coming on, dying under the judgment of God and having their bodies disrespected and dishonored by being thrown into a mass grave outside Jerusalem. Now, that is how, you know, those who read the Old Testament would have understood the Valley of Hinnom. Now, the question is, of course, did Jesus use the word Gehenna the way the rabbis did, or did he use it the way the prophets did? I think Jesus had more respect for the prophets and was much more influenced by the prophets than he was by the rabbis. And therefore, the rabbis used the word Gehenna to speak of hell. The prophet spoke of Gehenna as a state of judgment that would come upon those who were rebellious against God when Jerusalem was destroyed and their corpses would be thrown into the valley. Jesus warned about it. Jeremiah warned about it. It happened literally in both cases. And so there's good reason to wonder whether the translators were wise in translating Gehenna as hell. It certainly gives the impression that there's no dispute about it. And there is very good reason for dispute about it. They should have just left it Valley of Hinnom, because that's an actual translation of the word. Translating Gehenna as hell is no translation. It's an interpretation. The translation of the word would literally be Valley of Hinnom. And if they'd left it if they'd translated it instead of interpreting it, we would have perhaps fewer misconceptions than we now have about hell. All right. We're going to talk next to Stu from Sacramento, California. Stu, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve. I want to ask two questions about two real prophecies in the Old Testament, and have you seen if you can correlate them to a prophecy, to something in the New Testament. You're probably familiar in the 14th chapter of Zechariah when the writer talks about if nations don't come up to worship the Lord at the Feast of Tabernacles, they're not going to get any rain.
Yes.
And then also, at the very end, the very, very end of Isaiah, the last chapter, the last verses, talks about the feast days, the Sabbath being reinstituted. So I was wondering, I was under the understanding that that's kind of proof that the early reign of Christ written about in the New Testament book of Revelation is proof that that is a literal thing that's going to be happening, and those two things in the Old Testament are examples of what's going to be happening in the millennial kingdom. And so since that's really the only firm view and understanding that I have, I thought you would be a good person to explain to me other views or how I could be wrong or mistaken.
Sure. Well, the way I think the mistake that is being made there is that you're assuming that the final chapter of Isaiah and the final chapter of Zechariah are talking about a future millennium. I don't think that's the case at all. I think both of them, are talking about, I think both passages are talking about New Testament worship in the present age, but they are using language that's poetic and which is accommodating to the Jewish readers, where worship is assumed to be sacrificial. That is, using animal sacrifices, for example. For example, in Zechariah chapter 14, it says, verse 21, the last verse says, "Yes, every pot in Jerusalem and in Judah shall be holiness to the Lord of hosts. Everyone who sacrifices shall come and take them and cook in them. In that day there shall be no longer a Canaanite in the house of the Lord of hosts." Everyone who sacrifices, this is talking about a temple sacrifice, which is what, of course, is done at the Feast of Tabernacles in the Old Testament. However, it's not describing a reinstitution in the millennium. I don't believe there's any reference to a millennium in these passages. I believe that when you find these passages, Isaiah 66 and Zechariah 14, quoted in the New Testament and or alluded to in the New Testament, they always apply them to the church age. Now, again, we don't have animal sacrifices now, so it's clear that they're using language that would be understood by the Jews to represent worship of God in the, you know, conventions that they recognized. But this worship is now spiritual, not physical. You know, it says in talking about the present age and the worship of God by the Gentiles, which was a new thing after Pentecost, of course, it says in Malachi chapter 1, "For from the rising of the sun," meaning from the east, "even to its going down," meaning to the west, "my name shall be great among the Gentiles. In every place incense shall be offered to my name, and a pure offering. For my name shall be great among the nations, says the Lord of hosts." This is talking about the universal worship of God in all nations since the gospel has gone out outside of Israel to the Gentiles as well. And he says, hey, everyone's going to be offering incense to me. Well, I don't offer incense to God, because I understand this to be symbolic of worship in general. I offer up spiritual incense, which is my prayers, according to Revelation 5:8 and also 8:3. But the point here is that the Old Testament speaks about our spiritual worship using language that is, I guess the images are taken from the current kind of worship of the time of the readers. Now, it does not speak in Isaiah 66 of restoring new moons and Sabbaths. It says, "It shall come to pass," this is Isaiah 66:23, "it shall come to pass that from one new moon to another, and from one Sabbath to another, all flesh shall come to worship before me, says the Lord." Now, it doesn't say they'll come on the new moons, on the Sabbaths. It says they'll do it between them, from one new moon to the next. Now, the new moon was the first of every month, was the new moon. So from the first of one month to the first of the next month, that would be all the days in between. And from one Sabbath to the next, that'd be all 7 days. There's a Sabbath, you know, one weekend, and there's a Sabbath the next weekend. And from one to the next, all the way through, every single day, people will be worshiping God. The idea here is that in the Old Covenant, there were special days of worship assigned. They were rituals for ritual worships, like I said earlier, for animal sacrifices and so forth. We don't do that anymore. And we don't have the holy days anymore. Those are not reinstituted in the New Testament. But what it is saying is, whereas Israel would come and worship on the Sabbath day, and then they'd come the next Sabbath day, but they wouldn't do it from all the days in between. In the New Covenant, worship will be steady throughout the day, throughout the month, throughout the week, from one new moon to the next, from one Sabbath to the next. That is to say, from one Saturday to the next Saturday, everyone will be worshiping God in the kingdom of God. That is, in the church. And, you know, from the first of one month to the first of the next month, that's like 30 days. Every day they're going to be worshiping God between those times. So it's not talking about reinstituting those times. It's using language. For example, if someone's writing to us, they'd say from one Sunday to the next Sunday, because we think of Sunday as a church day. And God might be saying, well, listen, not just on Sundays, but all the days in between, from one Sunday to the next, all the days in between, I want my people to worship me in spirit and in truth. You see, the language is accommodated to the people it's written to, who are Jews, who knew nothing about worship except according to the Jewish law. And yet the New Testament's very plain that the worship of the Jewish, that's dictated by Jewish law, is no longer valid. And obviously not. There's no temple. You know, the temple was the central shrine of worship. Everyone had to go there to offer their sacrifices. There's no temple. There hasn't been for 2,000 years. There's a reason for that. It's of no use. All right? Maybe Stu's not there still. Anyway, I hope that answers your question, Stu. Let's talk to Kim from Las Vegas, Nevada. Kim, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling today.
Hi, Steve. I just had a question. If you could explain, I just became a little familiar with the 70 AD theory.
Yeah?
Where, like, Jesus already returned in 70 AD. Do you know what I'm talking about?
Oh, I certainly know what you're talking about, but I don't believe Jesus returned in 70 AD. But I do believe that 70 AD was a very significant date with the destruction of Jerusalem and the burning of the temple. I believe it brought to an end the system of worship that God had ordained 1,400 years earlier, and by which he had always required people to worship him at the temple in Jerusalem, and that Jerusalem had been the capital and the center of God's kingdom, Israel. And all that, for 1,400 years, God had had that system as the only system in place. So its destruction in AD 70, which was permanent, it has never been rebuilt. 2,000 years later, it still hasn't been rebuilt. Its destruction was a major turning point in terms of God's dealings with man, his requirements with man, and so forth. And so I believe 70 AD was very important. Now, there are a lot of prophecies in the Bible about 70 AD. In fact, Jesus said in Luke 21 and verse 22 and 23, he said that when Jerusalem would be surrounded by armies, which was going to be seen by his disciples. That happened in the lifetime of some of them, because the Romans came and besieged the city in the lifetime of some of them. He said, when you see this, know that its desolation is at hand. He says, this is the times of vengeance, so that all things that are written may be fulfilled. So the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD by the Romans, Jesus said, was so that all things that are written, he means the Old Testament prophecies, would be fulfilled. And there are many times Jesus in his own ministry predicted the destruction of Jerusalem. He said, not one stone will be left standing on another that will not be thrown down, meaning the temple. He said the same thing about the city in Luke 19. He said, oh, Jerusalem, Jerusalem, if you had only known that which pertains to your peace, but now they're hidden from your eyes. He said, for your enemies are going to come and besiege you and set siege mounts around you. They're going to destroy you and your children within you and leave not one stone upon another within you. So Jesus is continually making reference to this coming of the Romans to destroy Jerusalem. Now, that was very significant, and lots of prophecies in the New Testament and the Old have to do with 70 AD. But some of them used language which we call apocalyptic language. Apocalyptic was a genre of literature very popular in Israel in the time of Jesus and for some time before and after Jesus. In fact, Daniel had written his book almost entirely in apocalyptic. So Zechariah also. Many of the prophecies of the Old Testament are apocalyptic in their imagery. Now, apocalyptic imagery is very flamboyant, very sensationalistic. It describes very normal things like wars as if they are sensational, earth-shaking, cosmic, changing things like stars falling from the sky, the sun and the moon going dark, a great earthquake, every mountain splitting and so forth. None of these things are literal, but these are the apocalyptic writings speak about wars, ordinary wars, as if, this is the language they use. It's just very overdramatic. Sometimes in that apocalyptic language, the prophets would speak of a judgment on a nation, let's say on Egypt or Babylon, as the Lord coming against them. The Lord is coming to Egypt. The Lord is coming against Babylon. The Lord is coming in, meaning God is judging them. He's not literally coming. He's not literally leaving heaven and coming down to live on earth at that point, as Jesus will someday do at the end of the world. But there are times when the destruction of Jerusalem, because it was a judgment brought by God, is sometimes spoken of as the Lord coming. And this has caused some confusion for some people, because whenever we read of the Lord coming in the New Testament, we tend to assume it means the second coming, when Jesus actually literally does come back. As the angel said on the Mount of his ascension, they said, this same Jesus will return in like manner as you saw him go. Well, he hasn't done that yet. And that didn't happen in 70 AD. But we have to understand that some of the prophecies about 70 AD use this apocalyptic language and figuratively speak about it as if God is coming, as if the Lord is coming and judging Jerusalem. So some of the passages that are talking about 70 AD have been mistaken by Christians to be passages about the second coming of Christ, and for reasons easy to understand. However, I don't believe that 70 AD was the second coming of Christ. I believe the second coming of Christ is still in the future. But I do believe that there are many prophecies which my teachers applied to the end of the world and the second coming of Christ, which I now, in my own studies of the Bible, have realized they are really about 70 AD. Many, but not all. Now, there are people, they're a fairly minority view, but they're called full preterists, and they do believe that Jesus' second coming was in 70 AD. They don't believe there's going to be a future second coming. These people are called full preterists, and I believe they're wrong.
Yeah, okay, that's I guess where I heard it from, and I was like, that was crazy. Okay, thank you, Steve.
All right, good talking to you. Thank you for your call today. Our next caller is, looks like Jody from Lincoln, California. Jody, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
I was reading last night in the Old Testament about when Moses was up on the mountain, the people got restless and decided to make their own idol. And in the footnotes, it was talking about Aaron, and different scholars believe, oh, maybe Aaron was defying time when he was asking for people to bring their gold jewelry. And anyway, different thoughts about that. I was wondering what your thoughts were about that, because that's always puzzled me, how quickly Aaron seemed to turn on Moses.
Yeah, well, I don't really give Aaron much of a break there. I mean, I can see some people wanting to do so. And Aaron did seem to get off pretty easy for it. So, I mean, maybe God saw something motivating Aaron that was better than what I see or what's been revealed in the scriptures. But, I mean, he did get rebuked for it, but he didn't get put to death. And frankly, the law of Moses would have had all idolaters put to death. And in fact, that in that case, 3,000 men were put to death for worshiping the golden calf, but Aaron was not. So, you know, maybe because of this leniency that was shown to Aaron, perhaps, you know, they figure, well, maybe Aaron was relatively innocent. However, leniency was often shown to Aaron, which was not shown to others. In the book of Numbers, Aaron and Miriam both criticized Moses and seemed to be almost seditious against him. And God struck Miriam with leprosy, but not Aaron. Now, Miriam and Aaron were both guilty, but Miriam got struck with leprosy and Aaron did not. So it does seem like Aaron kind of gets off easy sometimes when he's doing the wrong thing, where others don't get off so easy. That may be, I don't know, but that may be because he was the high priest, and God, although God did punish high priests sometimes, maybe because this was the beginning of the whole system and so forth, God was going to give him a break. It is hard to know what did motivate Aaron to do such a foolish thing. In any case, the mercy of God toward Aaron is seen, and it may reflect something about a relative innocence in Aaron's motives, but I'm not sure that we could be certain about that. I'm sorry we're out of time. I'm going to have to stop right there, but thank you for calling. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We are a listener-supported ministry. If you'd like to write to us, our address is The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. That's P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. You can also donate from our website. It is thenarrowpath.com. That's thenarrowpath.com. Thanks for joining us. Let's talk again tomorrow.